All right, let's get back into our subject here of the nature of the child. Now, I know that there are other things I could do that would be more entertaining and more fun than this. And I was reluctant to do it because I know it's kind of academic and doctrinal and boring. But it is really a vital subject, not just for child training, but in application to you men and women and the struggle you have over sin, doing your duty, your laziness, your slothfulness, following the flesh. This has application to you to understand yourself. So we're going to talk about the conscience. Now, you remember my diagram of body, soul, and spirit, mind, will, and emotions. The conscience was not on there. The reason it was not is because the conscience is not an entity. It's not a faculty. It's not some part of the soul. It's not something that dwells somewhere in the body like the will is to the mind or the emotions is to the mind. In fact, the conscience is nothing more than a word we use to speak of being conscious, being self-aware, being aware of self in terms of how self is relating to everything that's around it and to the government, self-imposed government within. Each of us has our own self-imposed rules. Now, we're influenced by the Bible, by the community, by culture, but we all adopt some standards, some rules. Even an atheist has those rules. A homosexual has those rules. People in the prison, they all have their conscience, their standards. Now, the conscience can be seared with a hot iron, the Bible says. That is, it can be so wounded and scarred and abused that it becomes less sensitive. But all that's happened there is that the mind, the emotions, the will, the soul has yielded to the body. So the body has taken precedence and control and has dulled the voice that's within. So the outer man becomes the ruler and the inner man becomes dwarfed, diminished. So the conscience is the mind knowing itself. It is self-evaluation. As the nervous system is active relating the conditions of the flesh, that is, it's hot, it's cold, it smells good, it smells bad, in regard to pain and pleasure, so the spirit of man is active relating the quality of performance in regard to right and wrong. You know, this is one of the proofs, I believe, of our creation by God and of the existence of God. There's no way to account for man's drive toward righteousness, appreciation of it, and his guilt toward sin, except that it's something innate placed within him by his creator. Society cannot explain it. The rules of society cannot explain it, which the atheists would say is the case. They'd say that our good and evil, our moral, is nothing more than our perception of how we should act within the community so as to gain the greatest amount of pleasure. But that's not true for this reason, that everyone in the community has passions and drives, things they'd like to do, but they hold down because of some higher law that's inside. When the needs of the body are ignored, the body ceases to be in balance. Sickness, disease, nervousness, lack of sleep, heart trouble, different things take place when the body ceases to be in balance. So when the needs of the soul are ignored, the person loses his balance. Now, I would say to you that this is the true beginning of psychology, of psychiatry. They tend to think that their genetic reasons are some early life experiences that we're not conscious of influencing us. But I know that when people have emotional problems, when they are nuts, when they're taking Prozac or Ritalin to control their behavior, when they're having to go to therapy, is because they are right now at that time in their life treating their soul with disregard. They're ignoring the needs of the soul, yielding to the needs of the body. And the flesh is lusting against the spirit and the spirit against the flesh, and there's that struggle within. And they're seeking to find balance, but they can't because there's constant self-condemnation. And the physical right and wrong is not a moral issue, but right and wrong in the soul reflects on one's self-worth. Children, teenagers that cut themselves, people that commit suicide, overdose on drugs, most alcoholism, most excessive drug use when it becomes a chronic habit, is all based on a fact that a person has a poor self-image, a poor self-worth. They're attacking their own person with these things. It is a form of self-punishment. I remember one time when one of my daughters did something she wasn't supposed to do, maybe a year and a half old, 2 years old, something like that. And I turned to rebuke her, and she felt that a spanking was coming. She felt it was deserved, and that I was in a frame of mind to give her one. And so she immediately turned around, stuck her little rear end out, and gives herself four or five real hard licks like this, which was an offering to me to say, okay, now you see, I've suffered my chastisement. It's okay now. You can cool off. And so suicide is that very thing. One cutting themselves is that very thing. It is self-hating self and punishing self because of the evaluation of who self is. Now, other people's evaluation enters into that. But in the final analysis, it's what you're thinking about yourself, regardless of how you were influenced to think that way. It's what you're thinking about yourself that creates that. Children can enter into poor self-image very early by the way they see themselves in your eyes. Nature teaches us that sometimes there are things that bring immediate pleasure but long-range negative consequences, like eating poison, mushrooms. Now, every spring and summer, we go out and collect mushrooms. Shauna knows more about it than we do, so we take her along to show us which mushrooms are edible and which ones aren't. About a month ago, she grabbed up something that didn't look edible to me. It looked like the cow threw it up. It didn't have a mushroom shape. It looked like wet cardboard, kind of bunched up. But she knew what it was, identified it, and took it home to eat it and said, would you like to take some with you? I said, no, I'm going to wait 3 or 4 days to see what happens to your family. So eating poison mushrooms is a way to discover whether or not they're good or they're bad. But it can be a fatal experiment. I've often wondered over the period of history how people came to understand that that plant right there will cure stomach trouble, and that one will give you diarrhea, and this one right here will make you nuts. It'll drive you crazy, insane. This mushroom's poison, that one isn't. Somewhere along the line, enough people out of a small village or community had to eat the wrong mushroom and die from it or suffer brain damage before they figured it out. Now, that's the way we learn physically. Our children will learn morally the same way, but the problem is they might become addicted to poison mushrooms and end up smoking them or cooking them down and getting high on them before they come to the realization that it's something they shouldn't do. In some cases, the consequences are so dire, the choices we make in the physical realm, that we must take the word of others as to the danger of certain options. That's why we always in our house had a shotgun in the corner in the living room, sitting there where all the children could reach it and play around it. It was one I bought for $4 that wouldn't shoot. Had a broken firing pin. Of course, it never got shot, but it sat there in the corner, and the kids didn't know it couldn't shoot. They saw plenty of shotguns that could shoot, but it was there as a way to tempt them and to cause them to develop a respect for weapons. I think one child touched it one time and got a swift spanking on the back of the hand, and the other children never touched it. But it assured me that when they go into a house where someone else has a gun, a loaded gun, that they are not going to touch it. So in some cases, the consequences are so dire that we must take the words of others as to the danger of certain options. The bottom line is that there must be a final board to make judgments on the preferences of the body and of the mind. Now that board would default to my own brain, but children don't have the reservoir of knowledge and experience to make wise physical choices. So we make those choices for them and impose our choices upon them when they're very young. As they get older, we start letting the rope out a little bit and allowing them to experiment and make some choices that are going to sting or hurt or bite. The other day, one of the kids picked up a cat and was abusing. Somebody said, "Boy, that cat will scratch you." I said, "Leave him alone. He's going to learn right now." And so sure enough, the cat taught him a lesson. Now, if it had been a bobcat, I wouldn't have allowed that to happen, or a mountain lion, or a rattlesnake. But with a garden snake, leave that kid alone. Let him find out that snake's going to bite him. And I've been bitten 50 times by chicken snakes and garden snakes and water snakes and every kind of snake there is, because I used to show off how quick I was with my hands. And a few times I wasn't that quick, especially a little later when I got a little bit older. Now, the body and the sensibilities must be governed. So we govern the child's body and his sensibilities. We even tell him how he ought to feel. We even regulate how he should feel. And we instruct him in how to think. We are guiding him, trying to steer him into the field of knowledge that we've accumulated so that he can walk a path safely. The final governing board will, by default, be the flesh in a child. Or, with effort, great effort, constant attention, it will be the intellect relying upon the will to deny immediate gratification for a calling one considers higher than pleasure. Now, that's a mouthful. That's a very key principle. Men, women, those of you struggling with sin or personal problems, the final governing board in your life will by default be the flesh. If you just kick back and do what you feel like doing, it'll be fleshly. Or with effort, it'll be the intellect relying upon the will to deny immediate gratification. Now, this is not gospel I'm giving you. This is not the Bible way of deliverance from sin. I'm going back to basic human nature that's true whether you're Christian or whether you're not. These are the principles by which the human soul and body work and relate. Now, the gospel invades this system with a miracle that can bring cure and healing and deliverance where you and I cannot naturally work it out. But most of you are not really relying upon the power of the Holy Ghost sanctification to walk in righteousness. And you're making excuses. The reason I'm doing this, I'm going back to natural revelation, natural understanding, glorified humanism, to explain to you why you are, why you think the way you do, and why you function the way you do. My thoughts are that if you can understand yourself, that it will rob you of your present excuses before God. That it will divest you of these excuses that you've made over and over again, and you've overlooked the things taking place in your soul, thinking it's natural, it's normal. It is natural, but it's not right, and it's not the norm. Maybe average, but not the norm. So the final governing board with effort will be the intellect relying upon the will to deny immediate gratification for a calling one considers higher than pleasure. Do you have a value that's higher than pleasure? I know I've driven around this community here, this little city we have, and I can see that there is a prevailing preference for righteousness. There's a prevailing preference for that which is good and wholesome and holy, and it is a beautiful thing to see. But you know, I'm not fooled, and I know you're not either. I know that lurking in the heart of every one of us is darkness and evil. I know that the capability of evil things taking place are among us. In fact, in a group this size, even though we are homeschoolers and love the Lord and walk in righteousness, I know that among a group this size, there's at least a dozen child molesters. I know that there's at least 25, 30, 40 adulterers in a group this size. I know there's several closet homosexuals in a group this size, or lesbians. You see sin pop up every once in a while in the church or somewhere, and you say, well, how'd that happen? Well, it's been happening for years. No one knew it. Well, I'm telling you right now, it's happening here now in this group. But because of the prevailing preference for righteousness, while with groups like this and even at home and in your church, you conform to the norm, the Christian norm, because that's the avenue of greatest pleasure for you. You value your reputation. You value your family. So you conceal what is really in your heart and in your body. You conceal your enslavement, your addiction, your crime. But you know, one day you'll conceal it no longer. I've been responsible, my wife and I, for quite a number of people going to jail. A woman writes me and says, my husband, I found out, was abusing my daughter. What should I do? And we tell her how to gather evidence, how to protect herself from the law, and how to convict him and have him go to jail for 20 years. And women have written back and joyously celebrated the fact that their husband was in jail. They're getting Obama money to take care of them. Their children are no longer molested. She is writing him. He has repented in the jail, the prison. And she goes to see him once a month, and she's going to wait on him to get out. By that time, the children will be grown, and she will receive him back when his time in the pen is done. And we celebrate our great victories in Christ that we were able to have that man put in jail. Another woman wrote and said her husband was stealing from trucks and cars truck stops and took her son along. We helped her. They arranged the situation. The cops caught him, saw him, and got eyewitness evidence and got him put in jail. Now, if someone writes and says their husband's doing pot, I say that's not my concern, you know. Drinking a little too much, that's, you know, I tell them how to deal with it, how to overcome it, but you don't involve the law and stuff like that. But if your husband's a big-time dealer, a crack or cocaine, then I'm going to tell you how to put him away. Now, there's some of you here right now that one day your wife will write, probably after this event right here, when she's heard this. Now, so you better grab her and get out of here in a hurry. And she's going to say, you know, what you said was true. And she's going to tell them. We're going to talk with her a few times. We're going to find out if she's over-exaggerating. Sometimes women do. And we may have to talk to a pastor or some other friends or something. But then we're going to give our advice. And we're going to come down on the side of righteousness and truth. If you've messed with kids and we can't get to you first, then the law is going to deal with you. Now, we have at home a little kit that we use on the calves and the pigs that take care of that kind of problem. But the law does not want us to use it that way, so we defer to their judgment in those matters. I hope I didn't put anything in the wife's mind. I'd hate to see a man trying to stay awake forever. The struggle between the outer man and the inner man and the intellect is the final board of decision. Struggle between the outer man, that's that body of flesh that you've addicted to pornography, to adultery, to homosexuality, to any number of, to food, to alcohol, to drugs. The struggle between the outer man and the inner man, the intellect is the final board of decision. Now, the intellect is nothing, I'm speaking of nothing more than that part of us that reasons, that thinks, that reflects upon self, that takes in information and evaluates it. There are two kinds of values in life: pleasure, either physical or mental. Atheists have mental pleasure. College professors have mental pleasure. People of pride have mental pleasure. People in higher education have mental pleasure. Everyone experiences as an adult pleasure in thoughts, in logic, in reason, in study of history and different things. It brings great sense of pleasure. And then the second kind of value, besides physical or mental pleasure, is principle. Now, I feel good living by principle. Sometimes I have to deny my flesh, and that doesn't immediately feel good. But knowing that you're doing the right thing is the most exhilarating, clean, free feeling you can have in the world. There's great pleasure in being good. Now, some of you may not know that pleasure anymore. I tell you, it's worth finding it. The pleasure in not being afraid of God or man, of having a clear conscience toward God or man, is a wonderful thing. And that clear conscience is based on the present, not the past, unless you're concealing the past out of a selfish desire to return to it. But if you have repented of the past, and in the present you have a commitment to righteousness, and you see yourself overcoming sin, there is no greater pleasure than that. There is no greater reward than that. That builds self-esteem, self-image. Now, the psychologist would tell us that the way to build your self-esteem is to accept the fact that you are like everyone else in your faults. And so you just accept your faults and your guilt, and you learn to adjust to it and live with it without consequences. That's an impossible task. That's why you keep paying the therapist week after week, month after month, year after year. Humans are two parts. One part is born, the other part is acquired. We've discussed that. Now, one's disposition is what decides what he'll do and what he won't do. Disposition is the determination of how you are going to live. Implications go far beyond the child. One is disposed to act in ways that satisfy his greatest values. The Bible says, as a man thinketh in his heart, so is he. For out of the heart proceeds the issues of life. In other words, where your mind is, where your heart is, where your thoughts are, where your dreams are, where you imagine pleasure, that is the place from whence is going to come the decisions of life. Now, there's in all of us a conflict of pleasure. That is, we cling to the pleasure of being righteous and being perceived as right and being part of a wholesome community. At the same time, there's that pleasure of sin. Most people try to balance the two so that they don't lose their people's appreciation and respect for them. But sometimes the flesh gets too strong and people lose respect for you, you lose respect for yourself, and then it's a downhill slide from there. I've heard young girls say, "I've already given it away. What difference does it matter if it's a fifth guy or a sixth guy or a seventh or a one-night stand?" She's lost her self-respect, and now she's disposed to act in ways that satisfy her greatest values, which in the beginning her greatest value was to be loved, and she thought sex was the way to find that love. As a child or a man thinketh in his heart, so is he. As she thinks, so she is. As your child at 3 years old thinks, so he is. And you're the one that takes that learned part. Remember, they come into the world with a human nature, and after that, it's learned. Now, the part that you've allowed them to believe about themselves, That's what's made your child the way they are. It's not something genetic. That part is learned, and they learned it on your watch. Every action requires commitment to spend the resources necessary. If you want your glass of iced tea filled, you have to get up and go fill it. And except in my house, I just rattle the ice like this, and somehow it automatically gets filled. If you want the grass cut, you've got to go outside and crank up the lawnmower and find that it won't run, or the blade's dull, or the belt on it is frayed or broken, and you've got to fix it and repair it and go to all the effort, and then you've got to cut the grass. And then you have pleasure in the fact that the grass looks good and it's cut, and your wife is not nagging you anymore. So you have to make sacrifices whenever you make a decision. So does a child, and they need to learn that early. Some actions are more painful than others. The path of least resistance is the most attractive. The human battle of the ages is the judgment part of the mind, conscience, struggling against the mind already disposed to follow the dictates of the flesh. Now, how does the mind get disposed to follow the dictates of the flesh? In a child, it takes place when they're allowed a dispensation of indulgence. That is, when you ignore the six-month-old, the one-year-old, the one-and-a-half, the two-year-old's self-indulgence, demands, just satisfying the flesh. When you allow a runaway experience there, you allow them to cry and whine and get their way, then you're creating this pattern of the child yielding the flesh and ignoring the conscience in terms of dictate of right and wrong. So the battle of the ages is the judgment part of the mind, struggling against the mind already disposed to follow the dictates of the flesh. For the flesh lusteth against the spirit, and the spirit against the flesh, the Bible says. That is, in the flesh there is a competition, a desire to take control of the spirit. The flesh lusts against the flesh, wants the place of the spirit. And the spirit lusts against the flesh. The spirit wants to dominate and take charge of the flesh. So there is these two minds of a sort within us. There's these two propensities within us. One is high, right, and moral, and the other one is base, natural, carnal, fleshly, like an animal has. Not evil, just fleshly, just indulgent, just all that a child is born with. There's nothing sinful about desire or passion. There's nothing sinful about wanting food or having a need for sexual intimacy. There's nothing sinful about anger in itself. Jesus was angry. Nothing sinful about a number of things that, when allowed to run away and take charge and control, when allowed to lust against the mind and take charge of it, those things then become excesses and become sinful. Experts tell us that a child should be allowed to express himself without judgments being made. That's the way they try to deal with the guilt part. Not by causing the child to rise above the weaknesses of the flesh, but to just let the flesh take charge and then abolish the laws that say that's wrong. What the experts have not come to realize, because they deny the uniqueness of the human soul, is that it doesn't matter how you change the rules without and who fails to judge, that child has a resident divine judge that is condemning evil, anger, disrespect, and indulgence. And that child will grow up with this self-accusation, this conscience, constantly grieved, no matter what the psychologist or the psychiatrist or the progressive parents do to try to normalize their behavior by failing to bring judgment on it. So they say we should allow free expression. I hear a lot about, well, that's your truth. What is truth? I mean, that's an old question, right? Some people say, well, there's your truth and there's my truth. There is no your truth or my truth. Self-expression is limited when eating wild plants and swimming with alligators. You say, don't swim with those alligators. They're known to attack and eat people. Well, that's your truth. My truth is, I believe that God made everything and all the animals are part of nature. And if we're just loving and receptive and kind, that they will not bother us at all. And he's dinner for an alligator. Alligator loves that philosophy. Loves to eat little bitty, skinny, earringed, nipple-ringed hippies. So you see, there are certain truths that you got to observe. It doesn't matter what you think about them. Self-expression is limited when eating wild plants and swimming with alligators. To assume that expression is an option is to legitimize the feelings, or at least to assume that the feeling is not controllable. So when you allow your child self-expression, she starts throwing a little fit, and you say, well, just, you know, let her do it. That's the way she's expressing herself. Then you're normalizing that. And in the end, you're making that child a victim of those feelings, or you make yourself a victim. Teach children to practice self-discipline, not self-expression. You have no control over the nature of your feelings, whether you love or hate. Nathan talked about that last night. But you do have control over the intensity by passing judgment on the worthiness of those feelings. I've had people say to me, well, you see, I've worked in the prisons all my life, and I've had prisoners say to me, well, I just discovered one day when I was about 19 years old that I have a preference for the same sex. And so that's why I am the way I am. God made me this way. Now, if I question them, I will find out that there was an uncle in their life at 12 years old, or that there was a group of boys when they went through puberty that had some experiences together, or that they got into pornography, or any number of things, but there's always a trail where you can see that life brought them to that, not nature. And so these people have said to me, well, that's just who I am. That's the way I am. Here's what I say to them. When I got married, I was 25 years old. I was a virgin. I'd never had experiences with a woman. I had, by the time I was 8 years old, I wanted to. Every girl I saw smelled good. When I turned 13, listen, that lit a fire that I thought the devil had gotten a hold of me. And there was nothing greater and bigger in life than females. Their bodies were wonderful beyond belief. I was about ready to sacrifice my soul for one of them. I mean, that's your 13-year-old. You're just keeping it quiet. They're embarrassed about it. That's your 14-year-old. You just don't know it, but it's there. And I had girlfriends by the time I was 16 years old. I had time alone with them. And 17 and 18 and 19 years old. And I very quickly made some personal rules. I said, don't kiss them, don't touch them. Because listen, hand-holding set me off. Hand-holding would light my fire. Woo-wee! In fact, just brushing up against their elbow, I had to be careful not to walk behind them downwind. Smelling them did something for me. Men, are you with me? All right. And so I made some rules. I made some very strong personal rules. I was denying what God created me to be. Do you realize that? I was saying no to what God had naturally created in my body. And I continued to say no until I was married. Now, how could I do that? Because principle was higher than pleasure. Because truth was greater than my passions and my self-drives. Because I was regulated by my mind, which held values that were contrary to my body's values. And I also had the Spirit of God, which enforced my human spirit, so that I was able to exercise my will against the passions of the body. Now, let's go back to the queers. The queer says God made him that way. Yeah? Okay, I'll buy that for a moment for the sake of argument. And God also told you not to do it. You say, but that's who I am. Well, a sexual being is who I am too. And God told me how to exercise it and how not. So, if you yield to the will of God and believe the word of God, then you have power as a queer to not do anything queer. And if you don't do anything queer, you're not queer. A thought that you reject is not sin. A desire that you put down does not become sin. The Bible says, when lust hath conceived, it brings forth sin. Until lust conceives with opportunity and an action takes place, there is no sin. And so, there is no excuse for deviant behavior saying that God created you that way. God created you with a natural body of passions. If somehow life has bent and twisted your passion so you prefer a battery-powered tool or the same sex or something else twisted and warped, then that's something you created in time, in your own experience, or allowed to be created in you by media or something you took in, and you are still responsible before God to do what you ought to do regardless of how you feel. Sabotaging your child with a belief that he's a victim. You sabotage yourself with a belief that you're a victim. That's what the queers have done. The making of a victim. It's when you save your child, well, he's not old enough. She can't do that. He doesn't understand. Oh, he's a nervous child. His daddy doesn't give him enough attention. That's the reason he's the way he is. She can't help it. Oh, he has HAADDS or any other number of letters. He's just strong-willed, you see. What you're doing is allowing your child to be a victim of his passions. Or you're allowing yourself when you make those excuses. You say, well, I just have a thyroid problem. That's the reason I eat so much sweets. That's the reason I like cake and cookies. I got this thyroid problem. That's the reason I'm blown up like this. I got a thyroid problem. Now, I know thyroid problems can create a propensity, but folks, it takes calories to put on fat. And you got to eat fat. You got to eat the calories. Nobody's putting them in your mouth. You say, well, the way I was raised, the way my mama fed me, it's just, I did it, you can do it. I deny myself, you can deny yourself. It just takes stop being a liar and face who and what you are. If you allow the child to consider himself a victim, he'll not seek to control his temperament by force of his inner man. Parents must impart to their children the conviction that they can do whatever they ought to do, regardless of how they feel. If the child is led to believe that he's a victim of his feelings, he will be a victim of his feelings. There must be a will to bear discomfort for the sake of principle. People don't like effort. French philosopher said, all work is pain, and it is. Understanding alone will not help. That is, going to a psychologist or psychiatrist and gathering an understanding of why you function the way you do, or listening to me and gathering an understanding of why you function the way they do, or instructing your child. Understanding itself will not help. A child must undergo training, not get it explained to him. And so it is, you must undergo discipline, not just settle for an explanation. The will cannot change feelings and impulses of the flesh. Nathan talked about that last night. But it can refuse to lend cooperation of any other faculty to the impulse. Okay, discovering boundaries. We talked about how children discover boundaries by bumping into them, Two children playing together, one of them takes something from the other one knows that's not right. They start fighting over it, so one of them learns, for the sake of peace, to resist the desire to possess something that belongs to another. Selfishness of a child causes her to recognize boundaries. Society teaches one how to limit or postpone gratification in order to experience the most gratification. That's what happens to adults. That's why a lot of the crazy behavior of children doesn't follow people into adulthood. It's not that they don't still have the same impulses and drives. It's that society has taught them to curb those because there's a greater amount of pleasure achieved in society by not having everybody look at you like you're a dork or something. And so you practice some form of self-denial, though it's not in your heart. It's in your brain that says this is the way to get the greatest respect in life. So self-control is in their self-interest. Nobody was born with a sense of courtesy. That's not nature. That's culture. Our culture is that society in which we live and the way we learn to relate to it respectfully, honoring other people's limits and their boundaries. Nobody is born with honesty. That must be acquired through training. All children are liars. It's a matter of whether they become a habit or not. Children without responsibility become selfish rebels. They grow up to be totally out of control. Some of you teenagers right now here, or young 9 or 10 year olds, you're a selfish rebel. That picture right there is you. Look at it. You see yourself right there. That's you. You know why you're like that? Because you live to please yourself. You will not take your parents' teaching or instruction because you want to go your own way. I'll visit you in the prison someday. No, I probably won't live long enough. There probably won't be anybody who want to come see you. All right? Our first impulse is to be discourteous, like I just was. If anyone controls the inner impulse to be discourteous, he displays culture. Now, I admit I'm very short patient with people. I expect people to do what they ought to do. If they don't, then I just kind of sweep them aside, you know. I'm a dutiful person, and when people don't do their duty, I can dismiss them pretty quick. So our first impulse is to be discourteous. I think I'm pretty courteous to people, check out people, and when we go to eat out and things like that, I think I'm very, very courteous to them. But some people, if they don't treat me right, if they don't do their job right, then I can be discourteous just like you can. The average parent of today, encouraged by popular philosophies and psychologies, gives the youngest ample freedom to express their individual wants and to ignore the needs of the group and group discipline. I've gone to mothers, or my wife has, and said, your child is being mean to the other children. Oh, no, my child would never do that. Your child is a liar. Oh, my child would never lie. And so I've watched those children grow up and carry those faults with them into their adult life because their parents ignored those things in their life. Time was when a will to effort was systematically cultivated in homes and schools. On farms, stores, factories, men and women were trained routinely to expect of life a great deal of effort and a small fraction only of comfort. It was a way of life. People struggled to survive. They respected hard work in others. Even now, some of these old timers, these old farmers, they'll give you anything. They will help you. But you know, if you ever show any disrespect, discourtesy, or selfishness, they'll lend to you, and there comes a point they won't loan you a thing, they won't talk to you, they'll turn their back on you because they expect a man to live by his word. They expect you to be the kind of man that they have been and their friends have been and the other farmers have been, and if you're not that kind of man, they shut you out. And there's not many people left in this country have a will to effort. Schools don't teach it anymore at all. They make excuses for it. That's why we homeschool, one of the reasons. And there are not many kids living on the farms much anymore. Stores and factories controlled by the unions and by a union mentality, No longer people work hard. They just kind of loaf around to draw a salary. They think people owe them something. All of that came out of the homes. So they expect a great deal of comfort, no effort. They're Democrats. If a child doesn't control his antisocial responses in everyday life, he'll develop the habit. He will never develop the habit of control. Children are born with a will to dominate. It takes training to develop a will to peace. You know, if all your children have a will to peace, then parenting is an easy job. So communicating that will to peace, I think the best environment for that is a family that is unified in a vision, working, laboring together to achieve some great end. If they become bored, they no longer, you know, it's a lot, when you're bored, it's a lot more exciting to have a fight than it is to just relax and lay back. Because it's stimulating, it's exciting, the adrenaline flows, and so people will fight who get bored. So we talked about the natural man, the outer man, the flesh, the inner man. There's the chart again. Remember it. I have some tapes, by the way, called Body, Soul, and Spirit, some CDs. You do know that back down this hall somewhere here, back that way maybe, is right back there. No greater joy table, and then a lot of crafts. I suggest you go back there and see some of what the kids have made. Okay, let's sum it up. Children come into the world, no moral awareness. Get up about a year and a half old, they got just a tiny bit. And they get up about 5 years old, and they've got quite a bit of moral awareness. And then they get up about 14, they have 95% of the moral awareness that they should have. Actually, the scientists tell us that a child is about 25 years old before they're completely developed in their moral perspective. So the body knows only pleasure and pain. Lust of the eyes, lust of the flesh. Children live to indulge. They desire to be number one. The Bible said that's the three things in the world, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the pride of life that is not of the Father but of the world. That means it's natural. The pride of life. So those three things are in the child. Passions and appetite will rule the child's soul. The flesh becomes more sophisticated, as we talked about. Learns to discipline self for the sake of pleasure. Selfish ends cause them to not be selfish. So the flesh becomes more sophisticated, but not less carnal. In time, people give themselves over to possessions, to satisfying the lust of the flesh. The flesh lusts against the spirit against the flesh, and these are contrary the one to the other, so you cannot do the things that you would. That battle is taking place in all of us. It doesn't take place in the child because there's no spirit active to lust against, just the flesh. But by the time they're 2 years old, that spirit begins to prevail. And by the time they're four, you've got enough spirit there that they can be completely addicted to the wrong thing if they're not disciplined. Making the transition from dependence to independence. Stage one is stage of ignorance, 1 to 2 years old, trained by conditioning. Stage two, 2 to 3 years old, from 2 to 3 years old to 10 or 12 years old, they're growing into this state of accountability, developing a knowledge of good and evil, learning responsibility. During that time, you must hold them accountable. And they're trained by conditioning, but also by teaching and instruction. In stage three, the children are 10 or 12 or so to 20 years old, and they're becoming independent souls. They're growing into a knowledge of good and evil. They're becoming fully responsible, and they're growing into full accountability. They're trained, not by conditioning anymore, but by example and welcomed counsel. Too old to spank, too old to intimidate them. You've got to train them much like you would your next door neighbor if you're trying to influence them. So parent must assume responsibility for whatever degree of moral ignorance the child has, for whatever degree they're not fully developed, while we're guiding them into autonomous decisions. The Word of God says, we'll stop here, train up a child in the way he should go, and when he's old, he will not depart from it. Now, it doesn't say train him up, and when He will depart for a while, but eventually he'll come back. When he's old, he'll come back to it. That's not what it says. That's terribly abusing the words. Train up a child in the way he should go, and when he is old, he will not depart from it. He will abide with this as he ages, as he matures, if you train him up rightly. And I found this to be true. Many of you have testified and proven this to be true. Many of you are in the process of proving this to be true. And it's so good for us to come together like this, where you can see that you're not alone. Some of you feel kind of alone where you are. But you see that this is a small representation of some 2 million plus kids homeschooled in America. Now, I say plus because, like in our community, there's dozens, maybe 100 kids that are homeschooled that the government knows nothing about. They're not registered with anybody. They just do what they do. And so that information never gets into the statistics. And I know there are people all over America that's true. Small groups where they're homeschooling and they're not part of the statistics. So well over 2 million is estimated, and I think the number is much higher than that. We're training up their children in the way they should go. I don't think that anyone who sends their kids to public school are training up the children in the way they should go. I don't think it's possible to train up your children in the way they should go if they go to public school. Because the public school is spending 8 hours a day with them while you're spending one or two. They get to public school for 8 hours, TV or video games for 1 or 2 hours, playing outside for 1 or 2 hours, and a half hour running past you. And then you take them to church on Sunday and say, I taught them right. No, you didn't. You were the minor teacher. 5% of their training came from you. 95% of it came from their peers and from the Obama administration and whoever else is up there directing the soul of your children to their end, not to God's end. So you cannot send your children to public school. And I will add to that, you cannot send them to a Christian school where kids have gone to public school and now go to the Christian school. I've watched people that have kids that get in trouble in public school. And so they take them out and put them in the local Christian school to try to redeem them. And they bring the same garbage into the school, and your kids going to that school pick it up. Now, if you've got a Christian school that starts with kids at zero and brings them up and never receives a public school child into the school, and it's closely guarded and watched, and it's very small, then you might, if you've got trusted mentors in that school, you might get good results. But I think the only way that you can be guaranteed that child will not depart from the ways of the Lord is if you take the responsibility to train them up yourself. You're doing that. Continue to do that. Don't be weary in well-doing. Don't faint. Lift up the hands which hang down in the feeble knees and make straight paths for your feet. For in due season you shall reap if you faint not.